Ms. Garber, you need to take your time, get settled.
I'm fine.
Okay. You want to get a glass of water up there?
Yes, may I please?
Sure. You may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Blanche Barber. I represent the appellant RCBA Lands LLC in this appeal, and I want to thank the court for the scheduling courtesy that you afforded me today. In ruling that the original and photocopy of Charles Carruthers' August 12, 2003 will were two different wills, the circuit court made a mistake of law which led it to sanction the appellant, and thereby, by definition, the circuit court abused its judicial discretion, and that's a holding under Chbosky versus Brown. Accordingly, the circuit court's sanctions order must be reversed. Such mistake of law enabled the circuit court to probate the original will on its own merit as a different will, and thereby enabled the circuit court to do end runs around the 11-560 judgment in rem that established the Carruthers estate as intestate, and do an end run around section 64.2-448G, which statutorily barred Smith from filing his 14-234 complaint to establish the original, and do an end run around the longstanding case law prohibiting the reprobating a rejected will. And the appellant's allegations and claims stated in its 64.2-445 petition for appeal would have no relevancy to the original as a different will. Accordingly, the petition would be vulnerable to charges of frivolousness and sanctions, and exactly what the circuit court determined, that the appellant filed a frivolous petition for appeal. In its different wills ruling, the circuit court ignored the following necessary facts and law in deciding to sanction the appellant. One, the statutory definition of a will as provided in 64.2-100 and in its predecessor 64.1-45, which was in effect when Mr. Carruthers died on February 7, 2009. The definition that applies is a will is a writing that shows on its face testamentary intent and due execution. It's content-driven. Also, the circuit court ignored its own bench ruling in 11-560 that the original and photocopy evidence the same will. Number three, the circuit court ignored its own finding in the final order entered in 14-234 that the original and photocopy contained identical language. And four, the circuit court ignored the visual obviousness of that the original and photocopy evidenced the same August 12, 2003
will. Right, but that second order admitting the will, the newly found will to probate, you vigorously challenged that in court. You appealed it to this court. We denied the writ. So at that point, that's res judicata, right?
I beg to differ, Your Honor. I represent RCBA Lands, and the appellant was not a party in 11-560 or 14-237.
So it can collaterally attack the...
And the appellant is collaterally attacking the 14-234 final order on the grounds that the circuit court lacks subject matter jurisdiction.
But how can that even be right? Because courts can make mistakes of law, and that may be one of them, that the court should not have ruled the way it did. But obviously the Code of Virginia gives circuit courts the authority to review, whether something should be admitted as a will to probate. So how could it lack subject matter jurisdiction as opposed to simply committed an error of law, and that's the way it is?
Probate in Virginia is a statutory creature, purely statutorily governed. There is no probate statute in Virginia, in the Virginia Code, that authorizes a circuit court to reprobate a rejected will. In fact, if you take a look at the statutory bar...
Right, but the court said this is different, and that may have been wrong, and you vigorously argue it's wrong. I'm having trouble with the entire underlying premise of your argument, which is that what the court did in admitting another will to probate fails for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. We've been very careful about what constitutes lack of subject matter jurisdiction. I mean, that's like a circuit court adjudicating a bankruptcy petition. You just don't have any authority whatsoever, as opposed to a court making a mistake about, a warrant in debt or something like that. The code may not authorize something the court did, but obviously it can look at warrants in debt. So there's this distinction that we've drawn, and we've, been at some pains in our cases to get at this problem. So at any rate, I just throw that out there because I think that's one of the concerns I have with your entire argument, that there was no subject matter jurisdiction.
Your Honor, if you take a look at the probate section of the Virginia Code, the probate jurisdiction for the circuit court and for the circuit court clerk are defined. The parameters are defined within that section. If the authority is not there, it's not statutorily defined within that section, the court does not have the subject matter jurisdiction to reprobate the same will, albeit in a different form.
But that case was appealed to this court, correct?
Your Honor, my client was not part of that.
I understand appeal. That, but that case was appealed to this court, and the judgment was affirmed. Is that correct?
Yes, and so was the 11-560.
Right.
Order.
Both were appealed to this court, and both judgments were affirmed by this court. And so I'm trying to understand your argument that brings you here. Does it boil down to an argument that the clerk's order, which arguably implemented the circuit court's order to send the will to probate,
the original,
that the clerk's order was separate from the court's order and you were challenging the clerk's order? Is that your argument?
Yes. Well, if you take a look at 64.2-444, that's the probate statute that defines the jurisdiction.
So
that
in order
has.
For you to argue that your behavior was not sanctionable, we would have to agree with you that the clerk's order, arguably entering the court's order, was a completely separate order.
Well, Your Honor, we had to take a non-suit, a first free non-suit in the appeal because the clerk refused to enter the order that she was statutorily required to do. And that order was to allow the appeal to proceed. So given that circumstance, the appellant filed a motion for a non-suit to take his first free non-suit as a matter of right. But in sanctioning the appellant, the circuit court proceeded to determine the merits of the petition because It found the petition frivolous. Why? Because it applied to a different will, the photocopy. It's a mess, Your Honor.
No, I thought the circuit court found it frivolous because the circuit court had entered an order that the original of the will be probated. The clerk entered its order effectuating the court's order, but you challenged the clerk's order as if the matter had not gone through the circuit court. I thought that's why the court sanctioned you.
No.
Oh.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, tell me why. Tell me why, because
the circuit court at the November 3rd hearing reaffirmed its prior ruling in 14-234, albeit it was a bench ruling, that the original and the photo and its identical photocopy were two different wills. There's nothing different about between those two documents, Your Honor, except the paper that they appear on.
But that issue came up to this court, and someone on behalf of the parties arguing that it was the same document made that argument to the circuit court.
I was not part of that, but I don't believe that that argument was made. Original and the photocopy were two different wills. And I apologize for interrupting, Your Honor.
Now, the order in the second case had a specific individual who was going to be the administrator, right, who was named by name.
Yes, contrary to who was named in the will document.
Okay, right, okay. And then the clerk's office essentially was allowing that person to proceed as administrator.
Right. The clerk was exercising her independent authority to probate wills.
Right.
All right.
Right.
Not
I understand. But the point is,
will.
The clerk was just effectuating the earlier order of the court with this individual, right?
I think the clerk's order speaks for itself, Your Honor,
right.
And it does not state that it is effectuating.
Counsel, it says pursuant to the court order entered by this court on April 5th, 2017. Pursuant to the court order.
Your Honor, pursuant to is a rather broad term, at least in this document, because if you take a look at the language, you take the document within its four corners, and you take a look at the language, probate language, it's the same. It's a standard probate order. And I looked at that language, compared it with the language of clerk's probate orders from different jurisdictions, and found the language to be a standard language in an act statutorily authorized, enabling the clerk to enter the order.
I'm sure you've done more probate work than I have, but if the clerk was exercising his or her jurisdiction outside of the matter having gone directly to the circuit court, I have to assume the clerk's order would not be entered pursuant to a court order because there would be no court order. If the clerk was directly probating this will, there would be no court order.
I don't have the order in front of me, Your Honor. I'm kind of like a one-armed paper hanger, so I couldn't bring everything I wanted. But if I recall the language, pursuant to was negligible because it showed that the clerk admitted the original to record. What Mr. Smith has argued is that the final order in 14-234 was actually the document that admitted the order to probate, and I don't believe that's the case, Your Honor. Given my research, I believe that the clerk can exercise her own independent authority to admit anything she wants as a will, and then it's subject to challenge under 64.2-445. And that's how I saw the case.
How does the opinion of counsel, Mr. Somerville, affect your argument?
Mr. Somerville was appellant's counsel in the appeal of 14-234. And he advised me that if we did not file an appeal of the clerk's order, it would become, within 6 months from date of entry, a judgment in rem, and it would be incontestable. We couldn't contest. It would be a final order. As judgment in rem, it would be binding on all.
Go ahead, answer the question. And do I understand that the result of that would be that it would moot the pending appeal?
That was my understanding of Mr. Somerville's advice, but that wasn't the only grounds.
Right.
That we went forward. I believed that the court and the clerk lacked subject matter jurisdiction to reprobate a rejected will.
Let me ask you a question. If they had jurisdiction to probate it, how could they not have jurisdiction to reprobate it?
Because you can't have two bites at the same apple.
So that doesn't mean they don't have jurisdiction. It means they erred in doing it, correct?
Well, if you take a look, Your Honor, at 64.2-448G, that's a statutory bar against Mr. Smith filing a complaint to establish the original after the judgment in rem was entered in 11-560, that judgment in rem found that the will, the August 12, 2003 will, whether photocopied or original, was inadmissible to probate because it lacked a second witness signature. It was not duly executed according to 64.2-403.
It seems like what we come to is that you believe that the statutory bar robs the court of jurisdiction.
It denies, and under the circumstances that the statute describes as being barred. Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's the case. And the judgment in rem that was entered in 11-560, Your Honor, that binds all courts, all persons. And it was entered 4 years earlier and affirmed by this court 4 years earlier than the final order in 14-234. And that is the proper order. That is the legitimate order in this case.
Thank you.
All right, your time has expired.
I beg your pardon?
Your time has expired.
May it please the court, John Sawyer on behalf of the appellee, James C. Smith, Jr., who is the administrator and court-appointed successor trustee of the Belmont Revocable Living Trust. Your Honors, this case never should have been filed. When it was filed, I practically fell out of my chair when I saw it come across my computer. We had just wrapped up 3 years of litigation on very issue of the validity of this will. It was pending on appeal, timely filed, before this court. We were going into the briefing schedule. Counsel had been involved. Ms. Garber, while she was not counsel of record in that underlying case, was there the entire time.
Can I interrupt you for a second? As you were falling out of your seat, did you think about the fact that the sanction statute doesn't require her to show that she's right, that doesn't have to establish that we should have granted the writ? All she's got to do is have a good faith argument for an extension or modification of present law. She doesn't have to prove what the present law is. And the problem in this case for me is she's exaggerating her argument and claiming it's clearly the present law, blah, 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 that it's exactly the same will and you can't reprobate it and jurisdiction is lacking and et cetera. So the rhetoric is overstated, but her actual point, if you use the right vocabulary, it doesn't sound to me to be that bizarre. You've got a 64.2444 right of appeal, right? You've got prior proceedings dead on point. You have the in rem issue of the scope of the order. You consult with a very experienced and highly respected appellate counsel that says, look, this is your only shot. If you do not go through this door, it's done forever. And you come up with a legal argument that's novel and arguably wrong. In fact, let's assume for the sake of argument, it is wrong. But that doesn't mean you get sanctioned. It means you roll the dice. So it seems to me the whole debate we're having with her and with you as to what the right answer is under the law is missing the point. The question is, could she in good faith make these arguments hoping that she's got a, I don't know, what would good faith be? 1 in 3, 1 in 4, 1 in 5 shot of us coming to a different conclusion? So process the argument a little bit for a moment through that filter.
I start by reviewing the complaint that came across my desk when I fell out of my chair. It did not bring up those arguments at all. That is not on the face of that complaint. What is on the face of that complaint is that 14.234 should not have happened. All of its orders, or all the orders out of that case, are void. That this case should not have happened at all. Again, it had been going on for 3 years. We just had final orders entered. It's on appeal up to this court. Any issues that arise out of that case, this court is the final arbiter. This court will make that decision whether or not it stands or falls. And this court will decide whether or not there is an error of law to be considered. And
so
it was.
Your point is, as I understand it, is that this argument about I needed a placeholder lawsuit to avoid mooting my appeal is a post hoc rationale for what, in fact, was simply a retread of recently concluded, bruising, expensive, time-consuming litigation.
I think that is exactly the case, Your Honor. I think that is exactly the case. When you look at the pleadings on their face, that is what happened. At the last second, we end up with this.
But that litigation is not over until we say it's over. And it's pending on our docket.
Yes, sir.
Well, I, at that point in time, I mean, to follow up with Justice Kelsey's questions, the issue is not, is she right? The issue is there a good faith basis to preserve her ability to have her case heard on appeal here? And then the question would be, if you don't somehow contest the clerk's order, do you moot the case that's currently on appeal? That's the question. And it seems to me that she may be just as wrong as she can be. But it may very well be that it's the only way to preserve the ability to say that you were wrong before this court on a case that's currently on appeal. Now that's how I look at the case. Tell me why that's wrong.
I think the way to cure whether or not the circuit court was wrong was to appeal the matter to this court, which was pending. All
which
that
was
happened,
what?
The CL-14-234 case, the underlying will case, was on appeal to this court. That was the only way to.
No, you're missing the point. I understand that's going to resolve the ultimate issue, whether it's right or whether it's wrong. But she gets an opinion from a well-known expert in appellate practice and civil procedure that you're not even going to be able to argue that case unless you somehow appeal that clerk's order, because in 6 months it's going to become a binding adjudication of the rights of the parties that will moot this appeal. Now that's the argument that I see her making, that she shouldn't be sanctioned. She might be wrong, but she shouldn't be sanctioned for taking the only posture she could to keep that appeal alive in this court. Now, and that may be wrong. I understand that. But she gets an opinion from a recognized civil litigator in the Commonwealth of Virginia that's your risk.
And I go back to the colloquy I had with Justice McCullough, which is I only had, I think, 2 questions for Mr. Somerville when he was on the stand. And I handed him a copy of that complaint. And I said, Mr. Somerville, I understand the rationale. I don't agree with it, but I hear what you're testifying to. please show me on the face of the pleading before this court where that is brought up anywhere.
Well, counsel,
and he couldn't do it. Counsel, it's not there.
Counsel, why would she have to put that in her pleading? That is a, it was a strategy decision. It was a placeholder. What pleading have you seen that says, I'm filing this because if I don't, it might this order might moot out the case? I mean, she's filing her theories, right or wrong, but why should she have to say, give the issue of filing the mootness problem in that original appeal document?
My answer to that is that I don't think it was her intention to do that. She didn't put it there. Perhaps she didn't have to lay that out. But if that's the rationale for what you're asking the court to do, is to hold this in abeyance. And I would note that she filed a motion to stay along with it. The motion to stay had also been filed with this court in the appeal that was pending, which had been denied. It was basically a repeat of this again, using an LLC as the vehicle that was wholly owned by one of the litigants that was in the overriding litigation as a way to take, frankly, a second bite at the apple.
Well, and counsel, let me ask you this. When you filed the motion for sanctions, then she did say, I thought this was a legitimate move to moot it. She answered your question, should she have anticipated the fact that you were going to file a motion for sanctions and answered it as a straw man in her original complaint?
Yes, ma'am, because prior to ever filing a motion for sanctions, immediately after filing this case, I don't take filing sanctions motions lightly. I don't want to do it. It is not the way I like to practice law. It should be a very last resort. I sent a long letter to Ms. Garber saying, please don't do this. There is no good faith basis for this. You are costing the estate money, which ultimately goes on to the beneficiaries who have to pay that. And it's not right. Please don't do this. It was ignored. It wasn't answered. It wasn't justified. And that led me to the point where I had to start incurring attorney's fees in order to deal with this. And it was ultimately taken away. And what I've come to learn, Your Honors, and I know the court has seen this, is that this was but the beginning. I find myself now in an estate that's very ability to operate is jeopardized because we have litigants that refuse to acknowledge this court's ruling out of the prior
Let me ask you a question about the court's sanctioning order, counsel. Assuming that the court was correct in finding the behavior sanctionable, court awarded $20,000 in attorney's fees when the attorney fee affidavit is $12,480. How does that happen?
I think that the court awarded $20,000 in sanctions, not in attorney's fees.
Well, the court speaks to its order, and I'm looking at an order which says the amount of $20,000, which sum has been incurred by the estate in attorney's fees for the defense of this action.
And that came up in a colloquy with the court. I did submit my attorney's fees affidavit. I want to say at the time it was $12,500 or so. And the court said it is in the discretion of the court, having listened to all the evidence, that I am going to enter sanctions in the amount of $20,000. Now, that was an order that I had prepared where it was going to be a number written in, and I probably should have stricken through it a little bit more carefully because it was handed up and entered at the time. I will say this. Judge Shaw has exercised the patience of Job in this matter. He has been wonderful.
I don't question any of that. I'm just questioning as a practical matter. Is there a problem with a court's order which appears to enter $8,000 more in attorney's fees than were actually incurred and or requested? I understand the case law with regard to sanctions may not be limited to, don't have to be limited to attorney's fees, but this order seems to award more attorney's fees than were incurred.
As I recall, the order had a line in it where the number was to be inserted. And I should have been more careful in how I changed that final line. I would be the first to say that. But I think that Judge Shaw did not want to enter sanctions. I think he started off with this saying,
so
Mr. Sawyer.
Do you concede that the amount is an error partially? Are you conceding that the $20,000 was actually never requested and it's in excess of what you did request? Is that a concession you're willing to make or not willing to make?
I'm willing to state that the language saying that has to do with attorney's fees is not correct. I do not think the amount of the sanctions award was erroneous in any way. Frank, what's the point of a sanctions award? To deter conduct?
Did you ask for $20,000?
I did not.
So he sua sponte gave you, what, $8,000 more than you asked for?
He gave what he thought was appropriate under the circumstances, having heard all the evidence and reviewing what was before the court. What was before the court was, we have a clerk's order that says Mr. Smith needs to go qualify. He's already been, the wills have been admitted to probate, and he's already been appointed as an administrator.
I hate to sound argumentative, but a motion for attorney's fees is not a complaint, but in a complaint, the ad danum controls. In fact, the court has no power to issue more monetary damages than the ad danum. Why wouldn't that same logic and policy be applicable here?
I believe I asked for sanctions. I don't have the motion in front of me. I believe I asked for sanctions. And I think to justify the sanctions or to have a benchmark, I prepared an attorney's fees affidavit. So I think my motion was for sanctions. It wasn't for some certain. So I think it was left to the discretion of the court to decide what that some certain should be. The order referenced attorney's fees. It shouldn't have. It should have said sanctions are awarded in the amount of.
So if there's a Scrivener's error in the order, that can be fixed via non pro tonque to reflect what actually the court really did.
I think that's absolutely
right. So was Mr. Somerville's advice right or wrong?
I've never understood Mr. Somerville's advice to date. If that advice was we need to preserve the appeal that's going before this court, then my goodness, why wouldn't it be the appellants that were before this court going to rushing to the court to do that? That never happened. This case was non-suited. It was never brought back up. That rationale has never made any sense to me whatsoever. And I think, the complaint that was filed does not reference that rationale at all.
Well, assume for the sake of argument, you don't have to do that. You don't have to give that you don't have to give your strategy until someone accuses you of frivolity. But if Mr. Somerville's argument, from your perspective, on the tactical need to file this 444 appeal in order to not moot the pending appeal, if that's wrong, I'll assume that it is wrong from your perspective. Is it in bad faith to try to argue the contrary argument? I mean, being wrong doesn't mean you're in bad faith. It just means you're just wrong. We say that to 50% of the people that show up here.
All I can answer to that, Justice Kelsey, is the rationale provided on the complaint was lack of subject matter jurisdiction. I turn to your opinion dealing with the Critters matter before you came to this court and you were on the Court of Appeals. And I, if I may, read this to you. It is this.
I could interrupt you for a second. A lot of people disagree with things I've said in the past, and my response when I'm in disagreement is, I respectfully disagree. My response is not it's frivolous to challenge what I've ever said.
No, I think she searched for a rationale that came up subsequent to the filing of this complaint, and that was not the rationale that was going on. Rather,
counsel,
was
your time is running out, and if you could finish that, I just want you to know I have another question.
You've answered my question. Thank you.
As far as the validity of Mr. Somerville's opinion, the appellant cited in the trial court and here twice, First Church of Christ Scientist versus Hutchins, as the legal authority for the finality of the in rem nature of the judgment of the clerk when she entered the probate order. You have never addressed that case, and there was another one that cited it. So is your theory completely that she didn't tell us what she was doing? Or do you have any argument as to why those cases don't stand for the proposition that Mr. Somerville and counsel have cited?
This is why I highlighted the language that came out of the final order in CL 14-234 that went on appeal to this court. It stated that the will is admitted to probate. I don't think there's any question that subject matter jurisdiction is present for a circuit court under 64.2-443, that the circuit court certainly has that authority, and that the administrator, and there was a subsequent order that appointed Mr. Smith as administrator CTA of the estate. However, he had to go qualify. He had to go in and swear oath, and that was the process of what the clerk's order was. That's what that order accomplished. The manifold bond was even ordered in CL 14-234. So it was an administrative task. So, yes, I just don't see any reaction. When the order was prepared by the clerk, it specifically referenced both of those prior orders, saying, I'm doing this in furtherance of what has already been decided. I am not deciding that Mr. Smith is going to be administrator. The circuit court's already decided that. I'm not going to admit the will of probate. The circuit court has already done that. However, the man has to qualify. He has to go through that process. He came in, swore oath, and posted bond as previously ordered. That was an administrative task.
May I ask a question?
Absolutely.
As I understand the probate process, there are two ways that the will can be probated. One is through the clerk's office, and one is through the circuit court, which then the clerk's office enters the circuit court's, effectuates the circuit court's order. Is that correct?
I think that's correct.
Okay. So, as I understand their argument, her argument is that the clerk's order was not effectuating the circuit court order. It was the clerk probating this will, appointing the administrator. And so does the question of whether that, and maybe this is a question of right and wrong as opposed to trial strategy, but the question would ultimately come down to whether it was a clerk's order or a clerk's order effectuating a court order.
I think it was a clerk's order effectuating the circuit court order, because if you look at...
But if they were correct and it was the clerk's order, then they could challenge that clerk's order independent of the case that was already on appeal to us, if it was a clerk's order.
But we need but look at the final order in CL 14234.
I understand your position as to it wasn't a clerk's order, but I'm just asking. If it was a clerk's order, then the challenge to that clerk's order would have been appropriate, perhaps.
I struggle with that. Okay. I look at it from the standpoint of when the final order was entered in CL 14234, it laid out the requirements and said it would be complete upon qualification before the clerk. Had to go qualify before the clerk in order to comply with the circuit court orders. It's part of the process. That process had to be followed. We couldn't just have an order entered. The bond's been ordered, but that bond still has to be sworn into. Mr. Smith still has to go in and take oath. That's what was accomplished. Both of those orders were reflected in that. This was another bite at the apple, and frankly, we find ourselves in a morass, Your Honors, where every single order that is entered in any case is now appealed based on lack of subject matter jurisdiction. It is costly. It has brought this to a grinding halt. We can't even sell property because every single deed that is conveyed over that brings back property says this is based on, this is all under appeal to the Supreme Court on records that have even been dismissed at this stage. We are, and this is from the case that Justice Kelsey previously ruled upon in the Court of Appeals, where Ms. Garber engaged in this exact same conduct.
I guess I don't understand the morass that you're talking about. I mean, the other case is final. This case has been non-suited.
There have been a number of appeals that we have heard.
Yeah.
And this is not, Justice Kelsey dealt with this in 2012 and in 2014. In that case, it was personal jurisdictional issue having to do with one of the peritors on a divorce matter. And it turned into a litigant who believes he is a subject to a void order may seek judicial relief either on appeal or in collateral attack. But if a court of competent jurisdiction rules against him and declares the challenged order to be valid, that declaration is itself entitled to res judicata effect. If that were not the case, the litigant could file, as Prithers has begun to do here, an endless seriatim of unsuccessful collateral attacks in hopes of finding a judge who agrees with him. Prithers cites no legal precedent supporting such an aberrant result, and our own research reveals none that do. Well, that is where we find ourselves.
That was well said, but that actually wasn't in Somerville.
You do say so yourself. Yeah.
That is where I find myself, Your Honors, and we find ourselves on appeal. We've got four of them here right now.
Are there any other questions from my colleagues? If not, the court is adjourned.